crazy horse. We hear what you say. One earth, one mother. One does not sell the earth. The people walk upon. We are the land. How do we sell our mother? How do we sell the star? How do we sell the air? Crazy horse, we hear what you say. Too many people standing their ground, standing the wrong ground. Predator's face, he possessed a race. Possession, a war that doesn't end. Children of God, feed on children of earth. Days people don't care for people. These days are the hardest. Material fields, material harvest. Decoration on chain that binds. Mirrors gold. The people lose their minds. Crazy horse, we hear what you say. One earth, one mother. One does not sell the earth. The people walk upon. We are the land. Today is now and then. Dream smokes touch the clouds. On a day when death didn't die. Real world time tricks shadows lies. Red, white, perception, deception. Predator tries civilizing us. But the tribes will not go without return. Genetic light from the other side. A song from the heart. Our hearts to give. The wild days, the glory days live. Crazy horse, we hear what you say. One earth, one mother. One does not sell the earth. The people walk upon. We are the land. How do we sell our mother? How do we sell the stars? How do we sell the air? Crazy horse, we hear what you say. Crazy horse, we hear what you say. We are the seventh generation. We are the seventh generation.
And that was Mr. John Trudell, Crazy Horse. And just thinking about the last hour and to think of burial grounds being disturbed anywhere, it really does bother me. My gut everywhere. And I just think of that when I go I don't want to be touched or removed or anything. So, and I'm excited. Tonight you're on the air, and we're going to be speaking with Max Gale, and I'm real excited, Max. I hope that how are you?
Good. How are you?
And I'm great. And I didn't tell you this when we spoke on the phone, but me and my dad, when I was little, I used to go to bed with my brother and my sister, and I snuck down, and we used to watch Barney Miller. And we just loved watching you, and it was. And I know you probably have heard these questions, but it was a childhood thing. We just we laughed and we had a good time. And my dad's no longer with us, but I know that he's listening in spirit. So I'm grateful that you take the time to speak with us. And like I was telling you the other day, we were watching Charlie Hill. And I got this video from Evergreen, and you know, Charlie's no longer with us, but he did a lot of skits, and one of them you were in it, and just cracked us up. And I know that you've been a longtime activist, and you've shared the stage with many people, and Uncle Floyd was a really good friend of yours. And I remember the last time he was here at Evergreen, you came up, and you were in the stands listening to him, and I know that you're on the album with them. And so I just want to give you a little chance to introduce yourself, and then I'd love it if we could just share a little bit about some of the things that you're involved in. And I also have just one question. A friend of mine wanted to know, like, the baseball that's on your desk, you know, who signed it. What's the story behind that baseball?
Well, you know, it was a prop. So there were a bunch of them with just, the prop guys would write on them, but the idea was it was a signed baseball that Wojo had, I guess, the Yankees.
That's cool.
I never got all that specific about whose names were maybe on there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But that was the idea.
Yeah.
His one treasured thing.
Cool.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you great. And I did find a little bio on you, but I sometimes like it when my guests can kind of tell a little bit what they want to share. I know that we all have a different way that we want to share about ourselves, but I was wondering if you could just do that a little bit, and then we can talk a little bit about some of the things.
Yeah, all right. So I grew up in Michigan. I grew up in what they call Downriver Detroit, which is where the Detroit River, which is not really a river, it's a strait. That's why the French people called it the Strait, Detroit. It's part of the Great Lakes coming from Lake St. Clair, which is the smallest, and then on the way down into what is, you know, to Lake Erie. And I grew up on an island down there, and Downriver Detroit was the part where the foundries were, the factories. There were two towns, Ecorse and River Rouge, that were primarily black people come up from the south to run the, you know, work in the mills and the foundries and other things. And then there were the sort of Polish and Irish Scotch communities, Wyandotte and Trenton. And then it headed out into farm country. And I grew up on an island that kind of made that transition. It was the Long Island, and so that's kind of and there was a Navy base on the island. So there were kids in my, still a few farms on the island, certain number of dads that worked down in Detroit. Other people were tradespeople on the island. Canada was east of us. So we'd see the sun come. My family, we had a house on the East River Road. So we'd look across. The river started really widen out there. It was really like the mouth, I guess, they're going into the lake. So I grew up with those kinds of things. Part of the world I saw. My family went to Florida for 3 years. We went down to Florida. In the second semester of the school year, my mother had three sets of twins. There were seven of us within 6 years, five of us in the first 3 years. I'm the oldest. I have a twin sister, then a brother 2 years later, and a set of Twin Sisters just short of a year later than that, and then a couple more, the last set of twins showed up.
Wow.
And so for a few years, my folks worked it out so they could get out of the cold. And so I grew up, of course, Michigan is an Indian name. There was lots of evidence of, Indian people as well as the names around. My high school league was the Huron Valley League. Our big rival was Tecumseh High School. There was a big elm tree in the front yard of a house on East River Road that had a long swooping branch. It was kind of held up by a cable for a long time, but it just so we knew that the Indians, there had been a village on the island, and that Indians would mark a trail by pulling one branch down off a sapling and putting a rock on it. And this was one that just grew like that, and it grew into a tree, but with that shape. So I grew up, Wyandotte was the, all of that was around in a way, but it wasn't until we drove to Florida, by in names and a kind of wondering about, a world that existed not all that long before I was living there, in the lifetime of a tree. But then when we drove to Florida, I remember we stopped at the Cherokee Reservation. I had my first time that I actually met an Indian person. And I remember having something that we got, a birch bark canoe, had sweetgrass on it. So, and I just would fall asleep in the car sniffing that sweetgrass. Years later, I learned it was sweetgrass. But that I had that in my world early on. And I remember we would see Seminole people, and my dad would say, he'd say, look at over there, you see the fires, they're living outside because the weather's so good. And, it was just I'm going into that because that's kind of how, where I started into the life of things. And I went off to a college in Massachusetts that was a pretty good, it was a small liberal arts college. It wasn't, in my mind, an Ivy League school, but it was a really good school called Williams College. Came back to Michigan. I graduated from high school in 61, college in 65, so this was a time where you then had some choices to make about whether you're going to go to Vietnam. You could enroll, you could get drafted, or you could teach, which is what I did for 2 years, and then I went to graduate school. I wasn't a strongly convinced, anti-war person. That wasn't why I was doing it. In my 30s, one night up late talking with my mom, she said something, and it just clicked that she had raised my brother and I very early on to not go to war. Yep. Planted it really young. Because her father was a World War I psychological casualty. He was a great old Irish grandfather, but he was pretty much a washout as a dad. He made a lot of bad choices, and an Irish drinker. So I took that path. I taught ancient history and English in a school, a private school. They didn't care that I had no teaching degrees or anything. I went to an Eastern college and I played sports. That's what all these dads that sent their sons to this school were hoping their boys would do. And and then I went out to Ann Arbor. I enjoyed the kids and teaching, but it was a kind of stilted environment. And I went out to University of Michigan. I had been kind of a science geek and then ended up as an economics major in undergrad. And so there was one school still accepting applications. It was the business school. I said, fine, and I went and got an MBA. But I always say I majored in staying out of Vietnam. And while I was there, you could take one course out of the business school so that people could take a real estate law course or something like that. It had to be a graduate course. So I found that there was an acting course. I couldn't get it in the art school because I didn't have a portfolio. I managed to get into this beginning, the first level of the graduate school acting class. It was kind of a funny thing how it happened. I'm still not sure why the guy let me come in, but I did. And I thought it was called Theory of Acting. I thought we would watch movies and write papers. I was a little distressed when I found out we had to do scenes. Mm-hmm. But there was a moment during that time that I remember leaving an accounting lab in the evening and heading across campus to where the theater school was to rehearse a scene I was supposed to do for class from Othello. And we had been talking about depreciation and accounting, you know, and the ways that people, everybody agrees that machines wear out, but there are different conventions about do you take last in, first out, or first in, first out, or, you know, how do you actually decide how you're going to account for it? And that's all I remember, heading across the campus and starting to think about the scene that I was doing and what was involved with it, and realizing that while accounting seemed to be a very real world, down to earth, very specific thing, that it was all fantasy. And what I was heading to, which was considered fantasy, had a much deeper kind of reality to it for me. So I'll fast forward to now. As you say, I eventually went out to San Francisco on a kind of a fluke. There was a stage play of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest that had opened up. And it was raining. I didn't want to go to rugby practice. I just thought there was an ad put in the paper. They were looking for understudies. The production had opened, and it got a really good review, not from the theater critics, but from a very popular San Francisco columnist named Herb Kane. So they had a run on their hands, and they were looking for understudies. And I went down and read, and they offered me the understudy part of The Chief. And about 3 days later, they call me and say, you got to be here, you know, right away. The guy playing the chief had gotten fired. He had a kind of artistic conflict with one of the other actors over acting styles. And he had pushed him. And the guy playing the chief was a big weightlifter guy, and the other guy was one of these, you know, 6'3", 145 pounds. So the cast said, no, we can't have a wild man here pushing us. And suddenly I was on. And I was at a time in my own life where I was kind of going into a kind of my own, catatonic state of, you know, not knowing what to do about what was going on in the world and what was going to be my role in it and how would I respond to these things that were happening and all of that. So in a way, I felt an affinity for the chief, and I felt affinity for the play, and I did the play for 2 years. And had a chance to explore with other actors and do workshops and do a few TV movie parts and a film. I had my first line in a movie. I had one line in Dirty Harry. And then I had a part in the second Mr. Tibbs movie with Sidney Poitier. And it was called The Organization. And I had a little chase scene, and then Sidney Poitier caught me, and there were other actors on there like Raul Julia and Ron O'Neill, who did Chaff, I think, and you know, I found something that was that was meaningful enough to me to keep exploring it, and I went down to Los Angeles after a couple of years, and I got involved with the Actors Studio and doing other workshops, and went in and met casting people. I didn't get much work. I had been offered to go into the play in New York. They'd opened up a production in New York, and they said if I ever wanted to go into that production, they would put me in the part of the chief. So that's what I did, because I wanted to see what New York was about. The actors, a lot of the actors from the Actors Studio and others who I'd really connected with, you know, were from New York. And I did that, and I did a couple of movie parts while I was there and a handful of commercials, and came back to Los Angeles to read for a part I didn't get in a film called Day of the Locust. And then I started, graduate school, one of the ways I paid my way was to play piano bars and pick up rock bands. I played the piano a little bit, and But all the time I was acting, I didn't really do any of that. And then I I was back here, and I started, got a little place out at the beach, and I started running long distances. I ran half mile and mile in high school, but only because we had some fast guys in our school, and I couldn't run the sprints. But I didn't really train. I just sort of gutsed it out so I could get a letter. And but I started running long distance, and I started having these songs come to me, which were, you know, rhymes coming to me that were sort of a way of processing a lot of the spiritual seeking I'd been doing by checking out Carl Jung or, you know, whatever I was in that growing period. And I thought that's what this creative, that's what this acting thing has been about, is to get me into, you know, this place where I'm writing songs, not just playing other songs, other people's songs. And so I did the pilot of Barney Miller. I was thinking I'd just take the pilot money and go up to Big Sur and find a place where I could write songs. But the pilot got picked up. I did the first half season when we came on. A friend had shared some of my songs with Buffy St. Marie, and my friend was helping her with a tour. And anyway, it came about that maybe if Buffy could put the tour together to Australia, which in the end didn't happen, but that I could go along and be her opening act. They were showing Barney Miller there, and, you know, it was, I guess it was, you know, a way to make it happen. But so I went up to talk to Buffy about it at a recording studio in San Francisco, and Floyd Westerman was there. Buffy was rehearsing an all-Indian band and that she wanted to take, and then Floyd was there, and then Dennis Banks and Bill Waffipaw, a bunch of people came in, but certainly I recognized Dennis because all the time I was doing Cuckoo's Nest in San Francisco, that's when the Alcatraz occupation was going on. And when I was doing it in New York, that's when Wounded Knee was going on. So playing the part of the chief every night and Saturday matinee, you know, I felt a real kind of connection with all of that. And Floyd and I particularly connected. After they left the recording studio, they all headed over to the Indian Center over in Oakland, Berkeley. And I remember being there and Buck... They were all have been waiting for Buffy. And she got on the mic. She said, "Oh, so thank you so much for waiting. We're just going to get organized here. Floyd Westerman is here. This is Max Gale here. He's in that new show, Barney Miller, and blah, blah, blah." And there were 300 Indian people. "Max, come up here and say something." I said, "Wow, I did play across the bay here for 2 years. I never knew you guys were here." That was the first time I'd been in a bunch of rooms. They had a couple of drums that were active, you know, a kid, family. I have felt really at home in a way, but I'm going to sit over here and get on a learning curve. So next thing I remember, Floyd was singing "Custer Died for Your Sins." And I was sitting sort of off to the side, but, you know, still along the wall that was where they were using as a stage. And, A lot of the parents sent their kids up to get my autograph. And I remember looking over at Floyd, and he was getting some tooth work done. So he didn't have any front teeth. And he's singing, "Custer died for your sins." And he's looking over at me, you know, like, "Who's that Wasichu guy? He's got him all this actions happening." You know, these kids, you know, I'm looking at him like, "I don't know, man. I still don't know what to make of being asked for an autograph." And, we went out that night and spent the evening talking, and there were two things that Floyd said in our conversation. You know, I had already connected to, you know, just listening to him sing and stuff, and we talked, but at that time I was kind of fascinated with the idea of hang gliding off of Half Dome. I'd gone to hang gliding a couple times. I had had an accident. Danny Arnold, who created Barney Miller, he found out because I was kind of scratched up. He made me promise not to hang glide till the season was over because he said I got too much riding on this. And I kept meeting people who had done it or whatever. But Floyd was the first one that said, "Wow, that seems like sort of a unnecessary risk." You know, I said, "You know, well, you have to be ready to die to, you know, to really live." And because I was at that kind of stage of life. And he said, yeah, but you can sort of, you know, consider what it is you're risking your life for. And he was the first one that just sort of came back at me like that. Most people would either just think this guy's loony or else they were loony themselves and into it. And then I left him, you know, not a Frank Sinatra tip, but a nice tip for a couple of years. And he said, well, that's a pretty good tip. The guy didn't even, you know, give us good service. I said, well, you know, if it comes to, if you have it, you know, you got to share it. And he says, yeah, but you can, you know, think about who you're sharing it with. Doing his alpha male thing, you know. But it was also real. You know, I mean, we were really talking. And, of course, with Floyd, we spent a little time in the studio after and stuff, and that opened me up to another way of thinking about music and what it's for, you know. We had a Barney Miller cast on, but you didn't think I would talk this all along all by myself. But you're not cutting in, so I figured.
No, I'm loving it, and that's why I wanted you to come on, because I people need to hear this. This is great, and being able to, you know, you were there with you just said in the room. I didn't know that. That's amazing to me, to be there in that time and to hear how you came up.
Yeah, and, you know, it was a time right after the whole Doug Durham thing had happened. So, you know, Dennis had gotten kind of caught where he'd brought in a guy or trusted a guy as a, you know, a lot of groups, they take their most, let's say, challenged in terms of diplomacy people. You know, this happens in, just in life, you know, and they make them security, you know. And so it was. Doug was a guy that the FBI had some things on, and they got him to come and sort of insert himself into the movement. And then he went and testified, you know, to Congress, kind of fulfilling the distorted stories and stuff that, you know, that people were looking to hear. Yeah, these are bad guys, and so. But I remember still, you know. Dennis, I think after a while, people, one thing is they did realize, oh, now I know where I've seen that guy. And so I was identified, so they knew I wasn't a Fed, and I was identified with something that had to do with humor and smart humor. So that gives you a lot of cachet in the Indian world.
Yeah, they love humor.
The Indian world is a world of smart humor and deep, you know, and meaning something. You know, that was the beginning of that time for me. They had the Barney Miller cast on the Dinah Shore Show. Give you an idea how long ago this was. And they asked each of us to do something, and I did one of my poems that I got a lot of letters for. I did one of my songs, and I got one letter from, but it was from a guy named Gordon Jenkins, who had been Frank Sinatra's conductor and arranger, and Judy Garland, you know, he was kind of the Quincy Jones of his era, of my dad's era. And he invited me to come over to his house, and he wanted to make a copy of that song and did some others. And he said, I'd love to get this to Mr. Sinatra. His mom was just killed in a plane accident, unfortunately, so I do need to wait a little bit, but I think this he would really like this song. And that's kind of where I was, and then I met Floyd. And I kind of saw what was going on, you know, with that other, not that I hadn't been through this, you know, Bob Dylan and Joan Baez and all of that, but in a different kind of way, I was really seeing the ways that music, you know, what path it could offer. And Sinatra was by then kind of a, you know, old school, more Republican and, you know, Las Vegas. And anyway, I never did follow up on that. Although I treasure that memory in that time with Gordon Jenkins. But so the tour didn't happen. Floyd had come down to check in L.A. I mean, in Los Angeles, where I was living, with a friend he was traveling with, and we ended up getting in my van and driving up to see Ken Kesey up in Eugene, Oregon. turned out he was out of town. But then we drove across over to Colorado. He wanted to introduce me to Vine Deloria. You know, he was really, we had been out in South Dakota assistant at a powwow, and Buffy and at that point Buffy had just had her son Cody and Sheldon Wolfchild, Cody's dad, and so they were all together there. It was just a wonderful learning time. I remember driving across like Utah somewhere, heading east to Denver. Late at night, at one point we stopped at at the Custer place, 100 years to the day of the Custer battle, and Floyd and I pulled in there late at night. You know, that was the time just to be there. And then we were driving, you know, off into the night where the headlights hardly seemed to poke into the dark and the tumbleweeds blowing at you. And I'm sure we'd burned a couple because that's pretty much how we were traveling, you know. But I started thinking of envisioning these covered wagons coming out, you know, heading west as we were heading east, you know. And I said to Floyd, wow, I just been seeing covered wagons heading in this direction, and Floyd says, yeah, I was just thinking the same thing. I looked over into his eyes, and it really was a moment of realizing that there was a whole other side to everything, not just an intellectual. I understood it intellectually. I'd read, you know, Bury My Heart at Rome's Knee, and I mean, a different kind of realization. And then I that same summer ended up going to Sundance up at DQ University, where Dennis was kind of, having refuge in California from the warrant that was out for him in South Dakota that eventually he had to go back and deal with. So I was in a sweat lodge for the first time at the Sundance. So I was meeting people with PhDs and people who hadn't been out of high school who all had a whole transcendent understanding of the worldview I had been given so far was there was kind of, it's about the, you know, capitalism versus communism, the economy versus the ecology. Before that it was, you know, Protestant versus Catholic, but there was this whole understanding that transcended those and had a integrated, scientifically very hip, you know, understanding of things, and spoke to me spiritually at a time where I was, now I had a job. I could get all the drugs I wanted, and I was drinking a lot. And so I'm not sure, I think that all of that helped me not take a path my friend John Belushi ended up taking.
Yeah.
And then along that time, there was a thing at Alcatraz. I think the first time at Alcatraz was maybe the beginning of the longest walk, but maybe it was something else, because I met Charlie Furthy early on there too. Met him in a camper that they were using for Buffy was there. Connected with Charlie. I know what it was. There was an event also at over in Oakland, and that's where I met Will Sampson and Charlie at the same time.
Will Sampson. That must have been something, those two.
Yeah, and Will, you know, of course, we both had this, you know, kind of this experience with this character, Chief Bromden, you know, because that had transformed his life as well. He wasn't into acting, and Will and I, you know, also had became great friends over the years, and all those going back to those times, and in a way, some way that I felt like not only did I was on that path to learn and find out, but it felt like home. I felt so connected to things, and I was so welcomed, and I also, you know, was finding, oh, God, I'm in a television show, you know, was suddenly all this stuff that I hadn't thought of. The acting was all about internal and exploration and truth and all of those things for me, you know, and suddenly I'm in a hit television show and it's trying to figure out how to deal with that kind of pot of gold at the end of the rainbow narrative that was what every interview or whatever happened kind of was, you know. So I saw there was something useful that maybe I could do with that. And my Barney Miller years were also my years of, I was in a lot of Indian communities. Wojo became very informed by Indian Vietnam vets I met. You know, they say about Polish people, they think with their heart, and that's often said about Indian people. You know, that's what it looks like, the people who are totally caught in the head. So I had that kind of social economic understanding, but also the spiritual connection of the sweat and praying and Sundance and just understandings that I had that connection with sitting on on the earth, and those understandings were an opening of life for me. Now I think I should stop and let you ask some questions or whatever. But that was fun to lay that whole story out.
No, it's I'm sitting here and I'm just really loving hearing what you have to say. But we'll let people know we're listening to KAOS 89.3 FM in Olympia, speaking with Max Gill. And it's funny. I was fine all week, and then a couple hours before the show, my nose gets stuffed up, so I kind of sound funny. But I love the connections, and I love hearing, you know, the story. And when we talk a little bit about meeting Charlie Hill, but Will Sampson, you know, we have you must know Zoe then. She lives up here, and she's a close friend of ours here. And my wife is from Detroit, you know, and grew up actually in Dearborn, and hearing a little bit of where you grew up, and I've been there a couple times, so I can see that, and connecting with Floyd. But I'm just really, you did a few, probably more than a few skits with Charlie Hill. How was that?
What that was a show called Indian Time. One of the guys I met over, you know, as time when I was a guy named Shingoose was the name he took. He grew up, I don't know what name he grew up with, honestly, but he had a period where he grew up in Boys Town. Goose is a very Indian looking guy, you know. and he went to Boys Town, and then he's a good, wonderful musician, and singer, songwriter, and so he had a sort of a rock and roll period. And then I met him, and right at this moment I can't quite figure out how that connection happened, but anyway, Goose had great productions. You know, he had a lot of creativity and innovation and stuff. And he put together in Canada, he and a partner of his, a longtime partner, a white guy, a Wasiju guy, who was adopted by Indians. and they put together this musical comedy kind of show called Indian Time. I was the token white guy in the show, and it was primarily music, but we had some skits, and those I did with Charlie, and Buffy was part of that, and so she did one of the skits with Charlie. They did a kind of honeymooners, Indian honeymooners, and Charlie and I did one about the movie producer who's trying to talk to the Indian guy about how to behave like Indians.
Yeah, it's so funny. He's like, I don't do that. And at the end, there's $10,000 to do it. he stands up Charlie is hilarious. So I'm just cracking up. But to do those, you know, to meet with him, and I know that you've on many levels have done many things with Charlie and Floyd, and I wanted us to.
We did it. We did a lot of what Charlie used to call choker benefits. You know, where they would come at the end and say, "Well, we didn't, you know, raise quite as much money. You know, so and so forgot to call the radio station or whatever. So we don't have your honorarium," which at that time I was working. So I, you know, but for Charlie. At that time, you know, but we got these chokers for you, you know. So Charlie used to call them choker benefits. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's just funny. And I wanted just I got this 46 second thing that Floyd did, and I wanted you to talk a little bit about because you said he used to have fun with this one, and I only heard him sing this song once, and it was when he came up in 2000, I believe it was, and. There was a conference over at Frank's Landing, and of course Vine was there and Joanne Shenandoah, and he got up and sang this song fully. But I just wanted to play it and have you share a little bit of the memories with it because it's really funny.
Ain't that a shame what happened to Elvis?
Walking around in a jumpsuit that didn't work with a damn.
I'm not hearing it.
Oh, you're not?
So I
bought
me some. Well, I know what it is. Nobody knows I'm Elvis, right?
It's the Elvis one, yeah.
Nobody. I think that was Waylon Jennings. You got that from Waylon.
So, I know that you probably have heard him sing that many times, and I know that you have joined him on the album. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah.
Your collaborations with him?
Yeah. Well, I love playing with Floyd. It's a real exercise. Floyd was like a lot of the great old blues players. He might drop a beat and a measure here and there. You know, he was really into the moment and the story he was sharing. So you had to really be right with him, how he was singing it that time. You know, but his songs were so. Beautiful and touched on things that were so meaningful. And he was a wonderful country singer, you know. He could have been an Indian Charlie Pride, you know, but I don't think he would have probably lasted long just in terms of what it would have meant to him. And I think it was, he always said it was Vine Deloria that put him on the path and connected him. He had done an album of country songs called Indian Country. But Vine was the one who put him on the path and hooked him up with another songwriter, and they wrote the songs for the album Custer Died for Your Sins. But there was some problem with whoever had the masters to that. And then he'd done some other songs. There was a point where Harry Belafonte found him and his music and wanted to produce him as a country artist. In those days, country was very slick. They did a lot of chorus in the background and violins and a certain kind of high production that, for one thing, it just then meant he was singing along with a track, and that's different from him really just singing how it's going for him. Some of this stuff was good. We ended up making a deal with Harry and putting it on some of those tracks on the other second album that he did called The Land Is Your Mother, and then got some other musicians together to do that and re-record some of the Custer Died for Your Sin stuff. And that was just a sort of came out as, gee, this is something that should get done. And, I've got enough coming in to be able to do it on a shoestring level, which is really how it should have been done. And then I got to play background on a couple of the songs, which I really feel good about when I listen to them now, you know. And I found, the times when we would be out and do these benefits or concerts, there were always people that was the first time they'd been around anything like that. The first time they had heard the things people were saying about. You know, there'll always be lots of Indian people and people in the know, but there'll always be some new people that just opened them up. And so time came, 1980, portable video was just showing up, and you know, the half-inch stuff wasn't in the stores yet, but all the cameramen had them, and the news people were sending their three-quarter inch, you know, part of our portable video. There was no satellite yet, but these big cases and these 20-minute field cassettes that are bigger than a whole editing suite now, you know. And but it seemed to me that there was something that we could do to sort of turn the camera around in a way and share the kinds of events that we were going to and doing and kinds of things that were happening. And that all started to form up in 1980. My idea was a docu-musical. This was pre-MTV and pre-road rules and that sort of thing, but it was the same impulse. What if we do the whole song and not just have it be background for the interview, you know, but actually do that and all. We were at the Black Hills Survival Gathering, where South Fourth Generation South Dakota ranchers partnered up with the Nonooks people and the traditional Lakota leaders. And there were a bunch of rainbow people there too, you know. And we were up at Akwesasne when, right after there was a big confrontation. Matter of fact, when I was first there, it was when this encampment was still surrounded by state police, and they had just avoided a kind of showdown because Orrin Lyons had advised the governor not to try to go in there after them, and how the, you know, the other Six Nations would react, and then went back up with Floyd and his friend, and became mine, David Amram, who's a composer and conductor and jazz musician, an extraordinary guy, and was a friend of Floyd's. So we, you know, throughout 1980, we're traveling around and videoing this stuff, and I'm really happy to say it was all too radical for ABC. They were like, "What?" You know. They thought it was going to be, you know, Wojo does pottery. And so it ended up in the back burner after the show ended. I ended up in my back hall closet in a way for a number of years because I got married and had a kid, and we found out my wife had cancer, and then I became a single parent. And, you know, so in the 90s, I started to bring it back out and say, wow, this stuff is still just as relevant. And that's what led me into checking out computers, and then I saw Mosaic, which became the Netscape browser. So my path has been with that video in those times, you know, right on through. I've had life has taken me away from it in a way, and then right back to it. And I'm there again now. One of the young boys who came along as a sort of a intern is now a experienced editor from, you know, with a great background and stuff, and so we're digitizing all those tapes now. But with Floyd, it was, you know, just that opportunity to be a part of getting this I think really wonderful music out. We always laughed a lot, you know. There's a certain thing with Floyd and Charlie and that, you know, that Tehanshi relationship, you know, where there's a people have someone that's, you know, their job is to tease each other.
Yep.
You know, and
yeah.
But underneath it was Floyd, who could, you know, love to sing. God, he could do Dylan songs and Chris's songs. Chris Christopherson, just you know, he's in a category like Merle Haggard, and you know, he's that kind of artist and. But unique in the world, you know, and certainly, he was working on that. Actually, you know, when his health finally failed to the point where he went in the hospital, and this time didn't come out.
Yeah, hit that album is still, I think, to me and to many others, the theme song to Indian Country, and you know how important it is. To still be able to hear it. We play it here at Chaos, and we have memories of him coming here and visiting along with yourself. We had about 5 to 6 more minutes. What are some of the things that you're involved in now, and I know that you're still doing a little bit of acting and some things like that. So can we talk a little bit more where people can come out and see you? Because, you know, this is quite an honor for me to be able to hear your story and to share this time with you. And like I said, I have childhood memories, and you made me laugh when I was a kid. And my dad, I can still see my dad in the chair cracking up. And, you know, I just really appreciate the support you through the years with all of us and your support in Indian Country that helped all of us. So I just I
hope it did. I always felt like I was getting way more than I was giving, you know. But as far as it, you know, through the time of my wife's illness, I had a way, and I had support, you know, and I had you know, it just I'm just always thankful for having been able to make this connection and be a part of, you know, it's family and relationship. And I think, you know, as I started to say, I did in the middle 90s see the first browser before it was even Netscape, and got a sense for how I did find the world was sort of separated between the grassroots stuff that was going on and then the on-air realm. And it was kind of hard to get something on that on-land realm to poke through and have a meaningful connection in the on-air. And when I saw the browser, it was like, oh, there's this online thing. It was, I remember saying, gee, you could connect Sesame Street and Head Start. You know, so it in many ways, I got into the thought that we could have a better conversation as a species with these tools if we used them in the right way, but people had to have access to them. So I got into this idea of the local access proposal. I chose that word because the acronym is LAP, and LAP is a wonderful word that has to do with going around the circle and a nurturing place, and the way we use it, our domain, a domain of care, charge, control, and responsibility. So we all have our own LAPs, but our LAPs all overlap.
Yeah.
And so that's been my kind of central thing. At the time, I didn't know enough to know how long it would take. Things are just starting to happen now that I thought might happen in a year or two, where we can have internet, we can be doing an internet radio show, and we could shoot video and put it on the internet, and you know, it's all sort of mashing up now. And you know, that being ahead of your time is not that different from being wrong. But I've learned a lot over that time, and built a lot of great relationships, and I do feel like this is a time where we can be sharing our stories and what's in our laps, and sharing in a context that's real, you know, just the way it is around the Indian world, which is like, how do we, you know, put our hearts and minds together and see what we can do for future generations? How do we think in terms of you know, what works for all of life, for children of all species, for all time, as someone puts it. So that's been the through line for me. Acting comes, I got my appetite back again after a while, and my stash had totally run out, so so I am out there, and I had a part in 42, the Jackie Robinson film. Been doing some episodic television. I did a film called The Frontier, which is really about a father and son reunion thing, but so the title might be a little misleading, but it's a low-budget film. It premiered at South by Southwest. It's going to get a little theatrical release soon. It was the first time I had the starring part in a movie and was with it all the way through. I sure enjoyed that. And I'm getting out with my music and playing wherever I can, and you know, my youngest two are, one just got married, my son, and my daughter just had a baby, and so mm-hmm. my kids are getting on with their lives in ways that I feel like it's time to circle back around. And part of the process will be to take those old tapes and then talk to people and share them with people who have memories of Charlie and Floyd, who's not here anymore, and Will. And I feel like there's something, you know, looking for a way to share media that doesn't just polarize every issue.
Right.
And turn every issue into a debate so that the extremes then are, you know, projecting their shadows on each other. And I feel that we're at, you know, at that dark before the storm, or, you know, there's a lot of reason to hope. And
it's so much needed. To me, the wisdom that that all you've shared over the years, and for us to hear. So
I'd like to ask you, Brian, to make this an ongoing conversation, because when we first talked, I told you, you've been on my radar screen because you're a gentle spirit and sincere and thoughtful, and I think get right to the heart of things, and I think that there's a time for these, you know, for more sharing of these stories and these memories and the things that were happening back there. The country took a big shift to the, you know, to the right, and we elected Reagan, and a lot of us on the, I mean, I think we go around the circle. Whichever direction you head, it's all going around the circle.
Right.
And it's holding that circle is where we're going to solve our problems. And we are all related.
Yeah.
But I do think that maybe a lot of us got so sure we were right that we weren't paying attention to a lot of people that felt excluded by that, and now we're scratching our heads and saying, how could it be that we might lose the Senate, you know? And isn't it wonderful that we might not, and we might win the House, but as long as it's that sort of one side against the other and the extremes of things that people are saying about each other, you know, we need to find that center, and I think that's there within the circle you know, within that, in being inclusive of all that you, you know, I see you doing. So I'd like to propose that we make this an ongoing conversation.
Oh, I would love that. That would be absolutely, I would love it very much to be able to do this more than just this time. Yes, absolutely.
And anybody who's out there that's listening or hears the tape of this and it's caused them to reflect or want to share their story about over that time and stuff, you know, maybe contact Brian and contact me. My email is max@lap.org. Very simple, lap, just like the one that's there when you know, just like I talked about. And you know, use this, and there are some other wonderful people using these tools to share this, but let's reach out for each other and see where our laps overlap.
I like that. And my email is ravenredbone@gmail.com. And it is about what you said. It's about all of us coming together and sharing and moving together as people. And I think this sharing, we just got a few more minutes for the last hour. It opens up a whole new world for those that weren't there and that can understand, a deeper understanding of the humanness behind all of it.
And I think that, you know, because a lot of people who are the active in leadership now, they don't necessarily, you know what went on before there were casinos that brought some problems, but also brought, you know, health care and other opportunities. But there was a time where there was not. That grew out of asserting sovereignty rights, but it's not what drove it. It wasn't like, oh, we can make a lot of money if we do this. It was about something deeper. And I think it's good to, you know, it's good to make those connections. And there are a lot of people who have those memories and could share them with a lot of really smart, talented, young people who are part of the Native American world and the indigenous world, but, you know, that also essential part of the world that we humans, you know, hold with all of our collective views.
Right, all our laps.
Yeah.
And I agree with that wholeheartedly, and in that way we can grow as people and not forget. And that's one of the things that Floyd and many others have taught me, is that this is what happened, and we can't forget that. You know, this is why we have this over here, and with Uncle Billy just crossing, and I think that we realize that. And one of the things for myself is to, like, him and Floyd and many others fought for that, just for me to be able to sit here in this chair, you know, and to have that right to do this. And it wasn't about the money. They wanted to be treated equal, you know, as people, and stop what was happening. And I just appreciate that, and I appreciate being able to share those memories with you.
Likewise, just thinking that, and you know, there's another one, another great, you know, friend, brother, and teacher, really.
Yeah.
You know, so.
All right, well, I have to get going, but I appreciate it, and we will do this again, so thanks for calling this evening.
Thank you, Brian. I thank you for inviting me to do this, and I've just had a great time.
Yeah, me too.
So,
all right. Take care. Bye-bye. And you're listening to KAOS 89.3 FM here in Olympia. G-Dub is in the house, and just got this last little station ID thing to do, and we will be back with more Native sounds coming your way. I'm wondering if Gary's in a rock mood.
Comments made during the preceding broadcast of No Bones About It do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff, management, or underwriters of KAOS Radio or the Evergreen State College. Opinions expressed were those of the host and of the guests on the program. If you would like to express another opinion, address your comments to the general manager, KAOS, the Evergreen State College, cab 101, 2700 Evergreen Parkway Northwest, Olympia, Washington 98505. To arrange a time for your own commentary, contact the general manager at 360-867-6895 during regular weekday business hours.